First of all, I just want to say thank you to all my co-authors. There's several of them, but Sarah Connor's here today, and I just want to thank her. Without her, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't have this amazing opportunity. And especially also to Dr. Veal, who's the PI on this work and who taught me everything I know about kidney transplantation. So I have no financial disclosures to disclose. First, I'm going to give you a brief overview of kidney transplantation, why it's an important public health issue, and then I'll be going over the history of the field as it is relevant to living donors. And finally, I'll talk about some ways that transplant and public health communities can work together to address some of the really large problems that are affecting our nation in this context. So first of all, I want to give you a brief introduction to end-stage renal disease, which causes kidney failure and thus the necessity for kidney transplantation. It's fatal without treatment. There are two major treatments, dialysis and transplant. About 70% of patients receive dialysis, but it's a very difficult, very expensive process. So a typical dialysis patient is going to spend about 3 to 4 hours in the clinic 3 times a week or more. They'll be fatigued, they'll be weak, they often can't do the activities that they're used to doing, and they only have about a 35% chance of survival 5 years after dialysis begins. Also, the costs of this are enormous. Medicare provides end-stage renal disease care for people no matter their age, so it leads to an enormous cost to Medicare. You can see the per cost, the per person per year cost to Medicare are greater than $80,000 for one type of dialysis and about $70,000 for the other type, whereas the per person per year costs for transplant are much, much lower. Also, the rates of end-stage renal disease, these are per million population, have been dramatically increasing over time. And this is related to a lot of things, but one major cause here is that diabetes is the leading cause of end-stage renal disease. And as we know, obesity and diabetes have been increasing dramatically in this country. So this is a problem that we can see we've gotten a tiny dip at the end, but it's only been getting worse for years and years. So looking at transplantation, we saw that the transplantation costs are much, much lower per person per year. And it improves the quality of life dramatically. People can essentially return to their normal lives after a transplant, whereas when they're on dialysis, they can't work, they can't eat the things they like. So it's a dramatic difference in quality of life. But the problem is that there's an enormous gap between the supply and the demand. Median waiting times for a deceased donor organ commonly exceed 5 years, and about 5,000 patients a year die while waiting on the deceased donor list. So you can see there's two colors on this donor bar. One of these is living and one of these is deceased donors. Now the important thing about living donors is that the organs that they donate tend to function twice as long as deceased donor kidneys, and they tend to provide better outcomes. So that's what we'll be focusing on in this presentation today, simply because those kidneys are more effective. We can get more out of them if we can increase those donations. So next I'm going to start going over the history of living donation. This is, in 1988, they started collecting national data on who was donating, who was getting those transplants. So this is a really good effort to capture all of the transplants in the nation. But as you can see, living donors were increasing, but they peaked around 2004 in the nation and have been trending toward a decrease ever since. And our numbers are dramatically low right now. Now I'm going to start getting into the information from UCLA, our local transplant center. As you can see, our numbers peaked a little later, but we're also seeing a decrease locally in recent years in living donations. So how we got to where we are today were a lot of really incredible innovations in the science of transplantation The first success was in 1954, after the rejection process had been demonstrated to be an immunological process. So around the 1940s, we started realizing that the reason that organ transplants weren't working were because the immune system of the patients was attacking the organs as a foreign body. Now, Joseph Murray, who was a plastic surgeon in World War II, who went back to work at Brigham Hospital after he returned from World War II, managed the first successful donation between two human patients. These were identical twins, Richard and Ronald Herrick. Now, they had to be identical twins because of this immunological nature of the rejection process. Because they were identical twins, their kidneys were essentially identical in their genetic makeup, and thus the body did not recognize them as a foreign body. So they were able to complete this transplant and survive. So the differences between bodies with kidneys is a little bit more complicated than just something like blood. So blood, we know we have several different types. We have A, we have AB, we have B, we have O. But with kidneys, there's also something called human leukocyte antigens, or HLAs. And there are thousands of HLA types. So you may match a friend or family member who you would like to donate to on your blood type, but if your HLAs do not also match, you likely will not be able to donate. There's different degrees of matching, of course, but this matching is essential for fighting the rejection process. So in the 1960s and 1970s, we were working on elucidating what was causing the rejection process, since we knew it was more complicated than blood typing. And Paul Terasaki at UCLA ended up making a big breakthrough in developing a cross-match test, which eventually became the international standard, which helped find whether donors and recipients would match enough on their HLA types to make that transplant a success. Now, as a note for our local program, 1964 also marked the true beginning of the UCLA transplant program. So that's where our data starts. So without these HLA typing and cross-matching tests, you essentially needed to rely on luck or having a monozygotic twin to get a transplant. Otherwise, you would have no idea whether your body would reject that organ. So it's an extremely important process. It took a very long time to start to understand this process and to start using these cross-matching tests. So this is, again, our local data. We can see during this time, the therapy of transplant hadn't been implemented nationally really yet, because people still distrusted it. There weren't really reliable methods for determining when an organ would be successful. There was still a lot of rejection problems. So even though we started to understand this process, it hadn't yet really become a really promising national therapy yet. So in 1983, probably the most significant intervention in transplant history occurred, something called cyclosporin immunosuppression. Now, cyclosporin is used to essentially tamp down on that immune system which causes the body to reject organs. It dramatically increased one-year graft survival rates, it significantly decreased the risk of death due to infection, and it proved to the public health community that transplant was a viable option that might be able to, you know, address this problem of end-stage renal disease in a more national way, rather than just, you know, it being something of a novel thing that wouldn't really work in practice. So as you can see, after cyclosporin immunosuppression was introduced, transplant started to become a little more widely used. Compared to the 1990s, there were, if you look at the 10 years before cyclosporin, there were about 87 transplants at the UCLA Center. In the 10 years after, there were 185, so more than twice the number. This is where we see transplant really starting to take off. And really important for living donors were laparoscopic donor nephrectomies. So on the left here, we see a laparoscopic approach where you only have these very small surgery sites, whereas on the right, this is even something called a mini-incision open procedure, where, yes, the scar is smaller than a normal open procedure, but it's still much larger and much more noticeable than the scar you would see in a laparoscopic procedure. So this really encouraged living donors in that it improved their outcomes, it improved their convenience, they didn't have to spend as much time in the hospital, and they didn't have this very large scar that they were going to have to live with for the rest of their lives. So it essentially made it a much more interesting option for living donors. They didn't have to lose as much by giving up a kidney. So compared to the 1990s, there were 78% more living donors in the 2000s at UCLA, which began offering a laparoscopic donor nephrectomy in January 2000. Nationally, the rate of transplants from living donations increased by more than 90% during this time. And the procedure was disseminated relatively quickly. It accounted for 50% of all living donor nephrectomies by 2000, and by 10 years after its introduction, it accounted for about 80% of the procedures. So this is just a visual demonstration of that, the increasing promise of transplant and the increasing dissemination of the living donation procedure. So those were kind of the historical events that led us to where we are now. Now, as you saw in our first slides, there's still a big gap. So biological science has brought us this far, but there's still a lot that needs to happen before we can address that huge gap between supply and demand. So one thing that we're working on now, and one thing that Dr. Veal is very interested in, is something called kidney exchange. So as I mentioned before, HLA types make about 35% of willing living donors incompatible with their intended recipients. So kidney exchange was proposed to take advantage of these 35% of willing living donors. So just for an example here, these were the first two people who participated in a kidney exchange at UCLA. Jason is on the left, Tiffany is on the right. Jason's mom and Tiffany's dad both needed a kidney. But unfortunately, although Jason and Tiffany both wanted to donate to their parents, they were incompatible. So what we did was Jason donated to Tiffany's dad, Tiffany donated to Jason's mom, and everyone was healthy and happy. Now we can extend this idea through kidney exchange, which eliminates the need for example, Tiffany's dad to match Jason and Tiffany's mom to match, the other way around. You know what I'm saying.
We know what you're
saying. So what this does is it takes advantage of something called altruistic donors, who are people who don't have a specific recipient in mind, so often they would donate to someone waiting on the deceased donor list, and just one person would benefit from that person's generosity. What we can do with those people now is the altruistic donor can donate to an incompatible recipient. That recipient's donor can then donate to another recipient, whose donor can donate to another recipient, and so on and so forth in a domino-style chain. And then the last person can still donate to this deceased donor list. So the people waiting on the deceased donor list who don't have a willing living donor can still benefit from that altruistic donor's generosity, but also up to 30 other people can also benefit in this case. So the longest chain so far has been 30 transplants. We had a very nice write-up of that chain in the New York Times. It was a bi-coastal collaboration between, you can see kind of our different centers. These are really the major points of innovation in kidney transplant right now on the two coasts. And so something that's really assisting in the dissemination of this kidney exchange process is shipping the unaccompanied shipment on commercial airliners of donor organs. So essentially, you put a kidney in a box on ice, you take it to the airport, and you say, hey guys, put this in your cargo hold. And then somebody on the other end will be waiting to pick up the kidney, transplant it, or take it to the hospital, and immediately transplant it into the waiting recipient. So this makes it so that the donors can stay in their homes and recover with their loved ones. There's less transportation problems. It's a very cheap procedure. It's very safe. So it's really opened up the field to the dissemination of this kidney exchange process, which can take advantage of all of those willing donors who haven't been able to donate in the past. So we think this is a very promising strategy. And you can see that we had a pretty large increase after the implementation of these strategies at UCLA. And about 25% of our living donations now occur through exchanges, which is pretty major in our small center. Well, it's not a small center, but So one other thing that's important here is not just the biological changes and the algorithms that we work with to increase living donation. Also important is the social changes that happen over time. So recipient-donor relationships are something that's changed dramatically over the course of kidney transplant history. In the initial phases, essentially only a parent or a biological relative who had a very strong investment in the life of the recipient could donate, was ethically considered an eligible donor. Because it was such a high-risk procedure that if you didn't have that high emotional investment in the life of that recipient, it wasn't considered worthwhile to essentially harm the donor to give life to the other person. But now that the procedure has become much safer for both the recipient and the donor through the various biological innovations that I discussed, over time there is a large change in who is considered ethically an eligible donor. So we see increases in children donating to their parents and siblings donated to their siblings. And here in the bottom right corner, we see a dramatic increase in unrelated donors. Now, this reflects kidney exchanges. This reflects friends and coworkers donating. So essentially, it's dramatically expanded the network of people that you can request a donation from, which also expands the living donor pool dramatically. So looking ahead, we believe that it's social changes, like these changes in relationships and in these strategies to distribute organs, that are going to address this problem. It's not so much the biological and surgical developments that we've seen in the past that got us this far, but not to the finish line. So there are some strategies in the future that might help, such as xenografts and artificial organs, but they're so far off at this point that we think that one of the largest focuses we need to do is on social change. So important future directions include these exchanges and changes, increasing the dissemination of that strategy, working with other countries to do international organ exchange, encouraging altruistic donation and kidney exchange through large national and international organizations to organize altruistic donation and kidney exchanges, and also organ procurement and transplant network allocation policy. Now, the Organ Procurement and Transplant Network is a national organization that collects all this data and creates all the policy for who gets organs and when and why. And they recently put out a concept document on revising that policy. So if you have any interest, I would encourage you to go to their website and check out their proposed policy and maybe contribute to this effort by contributing your opinions. One important area is also addressing racial and ethnic disparities in access, which are dramatic, and which I'll be presenting on later this afternoon. I don't have time for it here, but very, very important. So again, the bottom line here is this huge gap. This is what we need to address, and we believe that the way to do that is through social change and collaboration between transplant and public health. Thank you.